This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Follow the truth. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And we are back with Dr. Terrence Palmer, The Science of Spirit Possession, now in its second edition. And that is available through the publisher, and that is Cambridge Scholars Publishing. We were talking earlier about your work with convicts, spousal abusers, wife beaters, sexual abusers. I'm wondering about, I don't know if you've worked with people convicted of homicide, but when you look back sort of historically at some of the more high-profile murderers, serial killers, people like John Wayne Gacy, for example, in America, or Mark David Chapman, not a serial killer, but the man who killed John Lennon. Based on interviews with these people, what are your thoughts about the possibility that serial killers, murderers, are affected by spirit possession or oppression?
Well, I've given this an awful lot of thought. In fact, when I returned from the United States, when I had been working with those wife beaters and sexual abusers, these ideas were uppermost in my mind. And I came back and I watched a television program on UK television. There was an American author being interviewed about her book, Helen Morrison, My Life Amongst Serial Killers. So I got a copy of the book and I read it. And as I was reading it, certain passages jumped out at me and demanded my attention. And I cited them, I made a note of them, and I put together an article that was entitled Serial Killers, Serial Rapists and Pedophiles. Are they evil people? Are they psychologically disturbed, or are they possessed? Now, this was an article that gave me my introduction to the university where I did my PhD, because that was my key, my introduction, if you like. And what's interesting is that when I presented this paper at a conference in Bangor, the conference was attended primarily by anthropologists with an interest in field studies with ethnic minority groups and traditional religions. So this idea of criminals being possessed by demons went completely over their heads. It was as if it just wasn't noticed at all. And that article, that paper, has never been published in a journal. I'm still sitting on it. But it gave me the idea. And when reading through Helen Morrison's book, it's blatantly obvious to me, when you read that with this knowledge in the back of your mind, it's blatantly obvious that when a killer says, God told me to do it, or the demon shouted at me to go and kill these people, that it is not just mental illness. There's a facet of that, yes, of course, because the person has lost their ability to exercise their free will. So you could call that mental illness if you like. But more recently, I visited the United States about 3 years ago by invitation to a group of people in Michigan that wanted to learn these techniques from me. And as soon as I arrived, the head of the organization said to me, "We've just had an incident locally. An Uber taxi driver has just been arrested for killing six people in Kalamazoo County. Do you think this has got anything to do with spirit possession?" I said, "Well, let's find out." So I sat down with a group of people. There were a couple of really good mediums there. We were testing the method, how it worked. And this was a case that we were presented with where we could test the method. We were given the name of the taxi driver. And we sat in circle, and I asked the medium to connect with him, and he was in jail. And then, and this is recorded, it's on YouTube, you can watch this, it's called The Kalamazoo Killer. And I had a conversation with the spirit entity that induced him to kill six people.
My word.
So the answer is yes.
And the accused in this case, what happened? Did he notice?
Well, he's regarded as mentally ill. Are you guilty of a crime? Was he sane at the time that he committed it? I don't know. If I presented this case at a conference in the UK at a university a couple of years ago, where we had a discussion about the legal implications of this. But it was a discussion between psychiatrists and theorists. I don't really know what the outcome of the case was, but we can only assume that he's, I don't know what the sentence is in Michigan for killing six people. Is it the death sentence or is it lifelong imprisonment? But I should imagine that his plea that the devil made him do it fell on deaf ears.
So, I mean, obviously, this is very controversial, to say the least, because then it calls into question the whole idea of personal responsibility in criminal action. So speak to that, if you could.
Yes, very, very tricky, very difficult. When a person is possessed by a very, very powerful and determined and highly intelligent spirit, it's very difficult to resist that. So a person who is weak-willed or vulnerable in some way is more likely to succumb. A person who is strong-willed and has a very, very powerful, strong sense of self would be able to defy that and beat that off. So, yeah. But then is it right to punish someone who's vulnerable? They're being punished anyway by the possessing entity. It's a very, very tricky area. And I can understand, and I've spoken to lawyers about this, I've spoken to top lawyers about this and discussed this, and the general consensus is that it's too tricky for the legal profession to even consider.
Is a spirit possession or oppression always precipitated by some sort of trauma to that person, to make them vulnerable?
I would hesitate to use the word always, but there is a powerful indication that would suggest yes.
Can it be physical or emotional?
Yeah, it can be physical or emotional. Yeah, the most vulnerable people are children who are abused in childhood. So people, young children who are exposed to satanic ritual abuse, and I've met them. We've had clients who've suffered this, and those that come through it and survive turn out to be extremely powerful, very strong people for being survivors. Of course, there are many that don't survive. They commit suicide.
Who else is vulnerable? You mentioned children who are victims of abuse. What about drug and alcohol addicts?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In fact, the cases that I deal with, every one of them is recorded. They're recorded in two ways. One statistical and the other is audio-visual when we are communicating on the case. So these cases can be studied statistically, when the cohort's big enough, and they can be studied phenomenologically with qualitative discourse analysis. And what we're finding is that a very, very high proportion of cases had vulnerability because of alcohol and drug abuse.
Can it be kind of a chicken and an egg type scenario, though? Because does the alcohol or drug abuse open that person up to an oppression, or does the oppression feed that addiction?
A bit of both, really. I'll tell you where it's dangerous. It's like a self-reinforcing cycle. A person can suffer a bereavement, and we all suffer bereavement. We all lose loved ones and friends, you know, and grief is a human condition that we all experience. But someone who is unable to accept a loss and goes into a deep, desperate depression may find self-medication with drugs or alcohol a relief, okay? But the moment that substance is put into the body, it depletes the power of the protective aura around us. And that gives, that is the vulnerability that is then penetrated. Imagine that you've got this aura around you. It's like a shell that protects you from infection, from spiritual dimensions. If that aura is perforated, becomes weak, then it's like the skin on your body protects you from insect bites, doesn't it?
Indeed.
And that infection. And you have an immune system that fights off the infection if it gets penetrated. The spiritual body is very similar. It has this outer skin that is depleted with any kind of chemical that's put into the body. And that can include all manner of drugs, not just recreational drugs, but medicines as well. So if a person gets depressed, goes to the doctor, gets antidepressant, it depletes the immune system and the aura, and it makes them vulnerable to spirit interference. So it doesn't help the problem at all. It just makes it worse. Self-reinforcing cycle.
We'll take another quick time out. Come back with more on the science of spirit possession with Dr. Terrence Palmer. Stay with us.
Don't be afraid. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. Dr. Terrence Palmer stays with us as we continue to discuss the science of spirit possession. And let me read you a definition of spirit release therapy from the second edition of the book. Spirit release therapy is a term that is used by some practitioners, but not all, to describe a treatment modality that has evolved from the pioneering clinical experience of medical practitioners, psychiatrists, and clinical psychologists who have encountered patients with illnesses that have not responded to traditional psychotherapy or psychiatric methods. Such pioneers have treated them successfully using their own intuition and by responding to the expressed needs of the patient and those spirit entities that are encountered in dialogue, rather than treating them according to predetermined theories and the beliefs and assumptions of the therapist. Spirit release therapy could therefore be described as a person-centered or perhaps a soul-centered therapy. Terrence, I wanted to ask you about schizophrenia, because you had mentioned that based on your research, virtually all, I believe you referred to it as all non-organic psychological afflictions are caused by a spirit attachment oppression. But what about schizophrenia?
Well, you can include that, of course. Let me correct you first of all. What I did say was that all non-organic illnesses, mental illnesses, are caused by fear.
Ah, right.
And fear is the attractant for a lot of interdimensional species that feed off that negative energy. Fear is just one of those negative energies. Anger is another one. Anger and rage will attract such entities. But yes, taking schizophrenia. Now, I'm not a medically trained doctor and I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not qualified to comment on psychiatric diagnoses. But my understanding as a psychologist is, and my experience of working with spirit entities, is that schizophrenia is a label given to certain mental illnesses by people who really don't understand what the real problem is. So it's a label to mask lack of knowledge, really, in my personal opinion. So very often we'll get a case referred to us by a family member of someone who's in hospital, usually a son or a daughter, but sometimes a mother. We had a mother recently referred to us by a daughter who'd been diagnosed with schizophrenia by the medical profession. And when we investigated, we found that she was afflicted with non-human, interdimensional creatures that were feeding off her vulnerability. And once they were removed, then she was returned to normal cognitive functioning.
What happens when a person is diagnosed with having some sort of an organic brain disorder, brain disease, but it's misdiagnosed, and it is in fact based on fear, as you say. Mm-hmm. And that person is given drugs, which seem to mask the problem.
Yes.
In some cases, it seems to alleviate symptoms. How does that work?
Well, let me tell you that removing the interdimensional life forms that use this vulnerability, that's the easy part. Okay, cleaning up the spirit is the easy part. The difficult part is getting psychiatry to acknowledge that the drugs are not doing any good at all and to have that person released from the medication. That's the hard part.
But the effect of if a person has an attachment, what mm-hmm. are the effects of the medication on that attachment, if any?
The medication doesn't affect the attachment. The medication affects the brain of the patient. The medication affects the cognitive functioning of the person and weakens their resistance to spiritual infection. This is a big problem for us because I don't want to be seen as negatively challenging the medical profession. What I want to try to do is to say to medicine and psychiatry, what we have to offer here is adding value to medicine. So when you take a person into hospital who's showing signs of psychotic behavior and hearing voices, consider this as well, not just load them up with drugs and hope for the best, because that's not going to work. Consider this possibility. Work with us to find the best practice for treating this person rather than just giving them drugs and not considering anything else. This is my message to psychiatry. I don't want to go to war with psychiatry. I want to help psychiatry.
One last time out, we'll come back and finish up with Dr. Terence Palmer, The Science of Spirit Possession. Stay with us right here on The Conspiracy Show.
Where there's smoke, there's The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
We're talking about psychological diseases, afflictions. What about the advancement of neuroimaging? What, if anything, has that contributed to your area of research?
Okay, neuroimaging is useful for illustrating what happens to the brain when a person is having an experience. Now, I'm not an expert on neurology or neuroimaging at all, but in my book, I have referenced experiments that have been conducted using people who have the gift of automatic writing. Now, automatic writing is a form of spirit possession where the person goes into an altered state of consciousness, into a trance, and the spirit controls the hand and uses it to write. And this is very, very well known in research methods in investigating spirit possession. And again, it's not common knowledge. It's not widely known. It's get very, very quiet. But there are neuroimaging techniques that can show what happens in the brain when a person is engaged in automatic writing. And it's well worth a read because the outcome is quite surprising. What it shows is that contrary to what you may think, when a person's hand is being used in automatic writing, there's very, very little activity in the brain. It's resting. It's being quiet.
Interesting.
So the spirit is using it without conscious effort of the person that owns the brain.
Okay. I'm wondering if there's been any experiments with neuroimaging and mediums who are communicating with spirit guides.
Now, that's an interesting question, and I'd love to be able to answer that that question by engaging in research to investigate that. So I'd love to hear from someone who has the equipment and the resources to collaborate with me on answering that question. I'd love to investigate that because I have daily access to lots and lots of mediums who do this work.
Talk to me about quantum theory and your area or your field of expertise, and what has particularly, you know, the three sort of tenets of quantum theory, what has that contributed to your understanding of spirit possession, spirit oppression?
Okay, so I have to use layman's language here because, I'm not a quantum physicist. I've only investigated this from my research reading of the experts. But what it does for me, it enables me to reconcile the fact that I experience on a daily basis that the work I do and the effect it has on people is beyond time and space. So we have the principle of non-locality, which is now firmly established in quantum physics. And that, for me, gives us a valuable and valid introduction to the possibility that quantum physics has a lot of the answers that we've been looking for in this area.
I'd like to ask you about the connection. When we're talking about an earthbound spirit who attaches to someone, mm-hmm. Is there a connection between a violent and sudden death and an attachment? In other words, if a person dies under violent circumstances, is that person more likely to attach to some living soul?
Yes, they are. We've had several cases where an earthbound spirit remains earthbound because of a sudden death in a motorcycle accident or a car accident or on the battlefield. We've had earthbound spirits attached to people where they've just been in the environment where an accident has happened, and the spirit finds itself out of the body, is confused, doesn't know where to go, but is attracted to a passerby because they just need comfort. If a child is suddenly killed, or if a child dies in hospital, they remain earthbound, they will attach to a person who has a warm and compassionate nature because they're looking for a mother figure. If an alcoholic dies and finds himself still earthbound, he will attach to a still living alcoholic. So there's a sympathetic resonance that causes, it's like a magnetism that attaches the spirit. Now, we've had some earthbound spirits who've been killed in a war zone. We had a family, a woman and two children, who got bombed into oblivion in during the Bosnian conflict. And a soldier that was serving there at the time picked her up, so to speak, and we worked with him. He'd actually been suffering from hearing voices for 23 years under psychiatric diagnosis of schizophrenia and PTSD. And came to us. It's recorded, it's on YouTube, you can watch it. It's all about hearing voices, the soldier that had a family attached to him that were blown up in the street. All kinds of things happen that enable an earthbound to attach to a person.
Is it possible to have a positive attachment?
Yes. A very common earthbound attachment is where a loved one has died, but the person who's died is reluctant to leave their family and wants to stay with them, and they attend their own funeral and such. Similarly, you have the family that are in such grief that they can't let go of their loved one who's died, and that causes them to remain earthbound.
And how many of us, I mean, I don't know if you have a handle on this, maybe there's been polling done, but how many of us throughout our lifetime are likely to suffer some sort of even ephemeral attachment. It may come and it may go all on its own.
Well, I would suggest all of us can be affected in some way, in one way or another. I mean, as human beings, we are vulnerable to infection from all kinds of things, aren't we? You can catch a cold, you can pick up an infection from another person. If you sleep with the wrong person, you can get a sexually transmitted disease. In fact, we had a case recently of a woman who had lain with a man who had been infected with what you would call a sexual demon, a succubus, incubus, and he passed it on to her. So we have a physical body that's vulnerable to infection of all kinds. We have a spiritual body that's vulnerable to infection of all kinds. I myself have had personal experiences of various different types of infection that have to be cleared with the help of colleagues. In fact, every month we all have a spiritual health check to make sure that we're still clear.
But not covered by the National Health Service so far.
Well, listen. I laugh at that. Listen, if the National Health Service employed the methods we use, it wouldn't be in half the trouble that it's in.
Excellent point. The Science of Spirit Possession, second edition, now available, and it's published by Cambridge Scholars. You can order it online at the Cambridge Scholars Publishing website. Terence, a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Richard. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I welcome the opportunity to try to educate people. It's not all fantasy. It's not supernatural nonsense. This is real, and it's scientific. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you. Okay, that's it for me. My thanks to Owen Wolf and Ryan White. Back next week with Mark Mirabello talking secret societies. Until then, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What I say in the dark, speak in the light. What you hear in a whisper, proclaim from the rooftops. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
The owners of the system are asleep. Now we can play The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
And we are discussing a spirit release therapy with Dr. Terence Palmer on the line from lovely Kent, England. And you differentiated between the remote spirit release technique and the therapy, which sort of is conducted face to face. So tell me a little bit more about the sort of the remote aspect of the spirit release therapy. What does that involve?
Okay. The big difference between the two is that the practitioner is not sitting with remote therapy. The practitioner is not sitting in the same room face-to-face as the patient, as the subject. That person can be anywhere in the world. In fact, 50% of my clients are on the North American continent. It's because the spirit is not of the material world. It is beyond time and space. So time and space are irrelevant. And this has scientific validity. This was investigated by the Russian neurologist Vasiliev in the earlier 20th century, where he proved the scientific validity of telepathic hypnosis. So science knows all about this. It just chooses to ignore it. Okay, but it is very, very powerful. It does work. In fact, this very day I sat down with a client, and I'll explain to you how it works. It requires, there are three people in the team, okay? So you don't have a single therapist sitting in a room with a client, which is the normal way of working, okay? You don't have that. You have a team of three people. You have the therapist. Let's call it the facilitator. Okay. I'm the facilitator. And the case has been brought to my attention. The person's asking for help. So then I will contact my colleague who is a medium. And a medium is a person who is able to communicate with the spirit world. Okay. The third member of the team is the medium's guide, which is a spirit being. And the spirit being can, in fact, just recently we've been working with, because I teach this. I've got lots of students and trainee practitioners working with me, and I'm teaching them how to do this. So we're getting to know an awful lot of spirit guides. Our principal guide is, the last time he had an earth life was 500 years ago in ancient China, and his name is Chen. And he's always with us. I'm sure he's listening to us now. All this, it may sound absurd to a lot of people who are listening, but this is reality. So I will connect on Skype with my colleague, the medium, and I will say to my medium friend, can you ask the spirit guide to join us? And the spirit guide will come in. So there's three of us working. And then I will give the name, the age, the gender, and the location of the patient. And the spirit guide will make the connection with the spiritual energy of that person. And then we will investigate what's wrong with that person and deal with it. So that's how the remote method works.
Now, going back to the case of the sales associate you met in the bookstore who had this rage, this anger, and yes. And you discovered in conjunction with working with the spirit guide and the medium that this woman was possessed by the spirit of an Indian chief who was angry because of the genocide that had taken place in North America, correct?
Yes.
And so how was that case resolved?
The earthbound spirit of the Indian was taken to the light where his spirit should have gone when he died.
And that was all done remotely?
Yes, and in fact, I was privileged to experience escorting him and going with him to the light. And this was the most moving experience of my entire life. I've never experienced anything before or since. But I'll tell you very, very briefly what happened. Under the direction of the instructor that was teaching us this method, all I could hear was a discarnate voice telling me what was happening, what to do. And he was talking to me as I was possessed by the I was the Indian. I became my consciousness became integrated at one with his, like like Spock's mind meld in Star Trek.
Yes,
you know? If you want to get a handle on it. So I became at one with the Indian, and the discarnate voice of the instructor was saying to me, you have to go to the light where all spirits go when the body dies. And he took me to the light, and I could, for as far as the eye could see, it was just white, bright light. It didn't hurt my eyes, but it was bright light. And as far as the eye could see, to the left of my vision were thousands and thousands of Indian braves that had died in the North American Indian Wars. And to the right were all the soldiers and the settlers that were engaged in this conflict. And in an act of reconciliation and forgiveness, they came together in forgiveness and recognized the futility and the stupidity of what had happened. And that was the most profound experience I have ever had.
And in that moment, the bookstore clerk was relieved of this oppression?
Yes. I had dinner with her later. And she was relieved, yeah.
It works
instantly because it's beyond time and space.
And did any of this resonate with her? In other words, had she had sort of unexplained dreams or visions of of Indians? Did any of this make sense to her?
It made a lot of sense to her because she had been to North America. She had long black hair. She was, I could see that there was a genetic link with North American indigenous peoples. And she held her hair in the same sort of design plait that they use in some tribes. And she'd been to North America and she had a sympathy with them. So there was the sympathetic resonance that she obviously picked up this the spirit of this North American Indian while she was there. And he felt that he could connect with her. So he shared his anger with her.
We've got about 2 minutes here till the top of the hour, and we'll continue on in the next hour discussing some more of these fascinating cases. But I wanted to get your views on reincarnation, because I'm wondering if spirit attachment is often confused for reincarnation. In other words, someone believes they're having memories of a past life, but what they are having are the memories of the entity that is possessing them.
It's an interesting question, and it can be resolved quite easily, really. Would you like me to explain how it's resolved right now?
Yes, please.
We just ask the spirit guide, because the spirit guides have all the wisdom, have all the knowledge. We know nothing. As human beings, we are ignorant, stupid, we know nothing. If you want an answer to the question, you ask those that have the knowledge. And it's written in the Bible. Have a look at the book of James, the epistle of James. It says it in the first five chapters, first five verses. If you seek wisdom, ask God and you'll get the answer. And it's true.
But what do you think of that idea that in many cases, all cases, some cases, that what we think we're remembering is a past life is actually a spirit attachment? It's that entity's life that we're living, not our previous incarnation.
Well, it is a possibility. And if you need an answer to the question, you have to ask the question and you will get the answer. Is this my past life? Is this a past life of someone else? What is it? You do get the answer. It's unraveled for you.
So in your experience, it's not an either-or proposition, in other words?
No, it could be anything.
Right.
Any number of possibilities. Yeah.
All right. Let's get ready for the second hour. Dr. Terrence Palmer stays with us right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Hello to everyone listening in on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM here in Toronto. Hi to all of you tuning us in on one of our affiliates across North America, and howdy to those listening via the Zoomer Radio and Conspiracy Show apps, those of you streaming us on zoomerradio.ca, and those listening via the YouTube channel, Strange Planet. Just a reminder, no live stream tonight. That returns next week. However and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. Before we get back to my conversation with Dr. Terrence Palmer on the science of spirit possession, a couple of announcements. First, it's time for our monthly draw for Patreon supporters. And this month's winner of Strange Planet merchandise is Rodney of Phoenix, Arizona. Congrats, Rodney. You've won a CD collection of my radio feature, Strange Planet, Volume 2. I'll get that out in the mail early next week. Now, this month's exclusive online chat with me on Discord for our whistleblower tier on Patreon is happening Thursday, June 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern. And the exclusive Google video hangout with me for Star Chamber Patreon supporters happens at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, again Thursday, June 27th. To become eligible for the monthly merch draw or the exclusive online chats, go to patreon.com/strangeplanet and consider becoming an official supporter. Now, I also want to remind you about my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, and new episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. If you haven't had a chance to listen, I strongly urge you to subscribe and have those new episodes delivered to your desktop or your device Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And you can listen and subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. We just launched this. It'll be 2 years in December, and we are closing in on 3 million unique downloads. So I'm very excited and pleased with its progress. Next week on The Conspiracy Show, Dr. Mark Mirabello. He's an author and professor of history at Shawnee State University in the United States. And he's appeared on the History Channel discussing deadly cults on ancient aliens. And he's also been a guest on Coast to Coast AM. He's the author of a number of books, including The Odin Brotherhood, a nonfiction account of contact with an ancient brotherhood, and A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, The Cannibal Within, and For Rebels and Outlaws. And again, Dr. Mark Mirabello will be with us for the full 2 hours next week. Now, let's get back to our discussion on the science of spirit possession. Dr. Terence Palmer has a degree in psychology from Canterbury Christ Church University, a master's degree in the study of mysticism and religious experiences from Kent University, and he is the author of The Science of Spirit Possession. I wanted to dive into some more cases. Okay. and your use of spirit release therapy.
Uh-huh.
There is the remarkable case of a young schoolgirl you discovered who was confined to a wheelchair, and there was no sort of underlying medical reason why she had lost the use of her legs. Talk to me about this case.
Yes, this was one of my very earliest cases where I was able to uncover the link between the power of fear in attracting negative entities. In order to discover the reason why this young woman had lost the use of her legs, I used a hypnotic technique where she was able to access past memories. And it's a very, very simple process. And I used to, when I was doing one-to-one therapy as a hypnotherapist, I don't do that now because I just do the remote work. But a very, very common and easy way of uncovering the cause of an illness is to say to the person, right, on the count of three, you go to that time and place where this problem began. One, two, three. And you can click your fingers and the patient goes there and you ask them to describe to you what is happening. Now, when I did this with this young woman, she was just 15 years old, her mother was in the room. And despite the power of the suggestion, she was reluctant to tell me what she was experiencing. She was embarrassed. She felt shame. So I brought her out of the altered state, out of the trance, and I said, just give me an indication of what was happening at the time that everyone was aware of. And she said, I was in the back garden of my friend's house. We were playing games. She was about 8 years old. And something happened that embarrassed her that she didn't want to talk about. And so I had to get the mother to leave the room because she didn't want to speak in front of her mother. And it transpired that a relative of her friend, an uncle, tried to molest her.
Uh-huh.
So the intense fear, going back to what I was saying earlier about the energetic vibration of human emotions, this sends out a beacon. It's like an explosion of energy, of fear. And this attracts the what we call dark force entity, a DFE. An interdimensional species that feeds off that emotional energy. And that's what she was affected by. That's how it came to be attracted to her.
And why would this DFE manifest itself in her through paralysis of her legs?
What you need to try to consider is that these interdimensional species, they need to sustain their existence off feeding off energy. So in order for it to maintain its attachment to her, it had to keep her in a state of fear.
And that fear led to the paralysis.
Yeah, well, that fear can affect you in all sorts of ways, can't
right.
it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But that was the key. And that was when I realized that and I began to form a hypothesis then. My scientific mind started working. And I went to a professor of psychology at Bangor University when I was doing my research. And I suggested to him that all non-organic mental illness is caused by fear. So if you think about it, with the exception of brain damage or chemical damage to the brain,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Interference with the normal function of the brain, with the exception of that, all other forms of mental illness are caused by fear. Mm. And I have been continuously convinced of that in all my work. So when we are working in this field, I'm working with my colleagues, and I'm teaching people how to do this. I say to them right at the beginning, fear is not allowed. It's not permitted. You cannot do this work if you harbor fear, because fear will attract the dark forces to stop you working. It's that simple.
And how did you, I mean, if it's the spirit of an earthbound soul, you direct it towards the light. If it's some other type of this dark force entity, how do you exercise that?
You just ask the spirit beings that work with us to take it away.
And the moment this DFE left this girl's body, what happened?
She could walk again.
Were you there to witness her getting up out of her chair and taking those first steps?
No, it took a couple of days for it to settle in. Yeah. I mean, if you'd witness a miracle, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes, yes.
If it happened like that. But suddenly it doesn't. It depends on the person. Sometimes they can recover in a day, sometimes a few days. But, yeah, you always need to check back to see how the person's doing. As a scientist, I need to know that this method works.
And that it's repeatable.
Yes.
Most importantly, as a scientist, right? You have to be able to repeat it. So tell me about the teacher who had this impulse to electrocute herself.
Oh, yeah, I bumped into her recently, actually. In a shop. That was a very, very interesting case. She, quite a detailed case, actually. It turned out that on investigation, we discovered that she had an energetic resonance from a past life where she had been accused of being a witch. This was in the 15th century in Scotland. And we found her imprisoned in a prison in Scotland, awaiting to be hanged as a witch. But she was a healer. She's like a lot of people, they have natural gifts of healing. But because of the persecution by the church in the Middle Ages, she was imprisoned as a witch. So in this life, she was reluctant to go into nursing, which was her first really preferred profession. So she took up teaching instead. Okay, so the energetic resonance, and it's beyond conscious memory, but there's something within the spirit memory that remembers these things. So she was a potential healer. Now, for people who are healers or potential healers, genuine spirit, genuine light workers, we are seen by dark forces as the enemy. And this is a constant battle between light and dark. And people and scientists may scoff at these ideas, but I have scientific evidence to support these hypotheses. People who work in this field are under constant attack from dark forces that tried to stop us from working. And this is what was happening to this woman. She had a demonic type creature with her that was inducing her into the irresistible impulse to put her fingers in live electric light sockets so that she would expire. And she was fighting hard to resist it. So when we discovered what was causing it and removed it, then she was fine.
Finally, I wanted to talk to you about the possession of a patient by an entity that was identified as Dark Samuel. Tell me about that case.
Yeah. Dark Samuel. He was earthbound. He was the spirit of a person who'd lived an earth life. He was a man who died. And in a previous life, he had possessed this person, the patient, the client, as a slave. And when he died, he didn't want to relinquish his possession. So he remained earthbound and kept her to himself. He was working hard to prevent her from living a normal life, having normal relationships. She couldn't marry anyone. She couldn't maintain a relationship because he was preventing it. So and what was interesting about him was that he was so dark, I just called him Dark Samuel. When we release someone to the light, what we normally do is ask for someone who loves them to come and collect them and show them the way, someone who's gone before. And that usually works rather well. But in Dark Samuel's case, there was no one who loved him, no one who went before, who wanted to, who wanted to escort him. So this presented a bit of a problem. So I thought, well, what do we do now? And then again, in answer to that question, what do we do now? If you send a serious question out to the universe, you will get an answer. And in answer to my plea for help, one of the archangels came. I think it was Gabriel, came to escort him. And Dark Samuel started whimpering and showing signs of fear. And I said, "What's the matter, Samuel?" He said, "Gabriel come to get me. I can't argue with him, so I'd better go." It was quite funny.
What do you say to the skeptics who might suggest that this this effect that you're having, or that your team is having through spiritual release therapy, is an example of the placebo effect?
Yes, it's an interesting idea, isn't it? A placebo itself is an interesting idea, because what placebo actually demonstrates is the power of belief, doesn't it?
Yes.
That's all it is. Placebo is the power of belief. And yes, there could be an element of that attached to this method. If a person believes that what you're doing is going to heal them and it works, yeah, it could be the power of placebo. In order to test against that, what we do is, and this is where the scientific method comes into its own. When I receive a request for help from a client, I don't tell the medium anything about the details of the case. The medium has no preconceived ideas. It's just another case, and it could involve anything. We work on the case. We deal with the problem that's presented, and then I will leave it for 24 hours and wait for the intervention to start having an effect, okay? My favorite procedure is to do nothing, is just to wait for that client to contact me and say, what did you do and when did you do it? Because I'm feeling so much better. So if the client doesn't know when the procedure is being conducted, it can't be placebo, can it?
Right. And you have cases, or have you had cases, where the patient, if I can use that term, they don't believe, and yet it works anyway?
Yes, many of our cases are brought by family members on behalf of their loved ones. Extreme examples of this are where you have a parent who has a a son, usually a son, sometimes a daughter, who's been sectioned, is in psychiatric hospital or in prison, but generally in psychiatric hospital on antipsychotic medication, so that they have no conscious awareness of what's going on. You can't communicate with them. You can't even reach them physically. So, and when we work on cases like this, it doesn't matter what the patient believes or doesn't believe, because they're consciously non-functioning anyway. But when they recover and the psychiatrists have no other course of action than to release them from hospital, how do you explain that?
You know, what's fascinating is that the field of psychology, and I'm gathering that, you know, the vast, vast majority do not believe in this, they would probably even deny the existence of the soul. Yet the root word of psychology, psyche, literally means soul in Greek.
Yes, it does, yes.
I wanted to ask you about, because you came to America and you worked with another member of the Spirit Release Foundation, and you were working with convicted spousal abusers, wife beaters, and sexual abusers.
Yes.
Tell me about your work in America, working with these convicts.
Well, I was introduced to a gentleman who had been appointed by the court as a facilitator to help these convicted criminals adapt and change their behavior. They were appointed, they were ordered by a court of law to attend to his rehabilitation program for a year. And he had about 10 or 12 people that he was working with. And I asked him if he'd be interested in learning something that would help him with his work. And he said, yes, of course, I would. So I taught him the method, introduced him to the method, and then asked him to ask his cohort of people that he was working with if any of them would like to volunteer for this method. And there were three or four volunteers said they'd like to try it. And, of course, they didn't have to do anything. They didn't know when it was going to happen. They just went about their business normally. But we worked on three or four cases, and the difference that these people felt was reported. So the facilitator of this program was absolutely amazed. He said, "This is wonderful. We have to use this." So he went to his employer, the Pennsylvania State Judiciary, or whatever the name of the organization was that appointed him as rehabilitation manager. He went to them and said, "This is the method. Can we employ it?" And they said, "Well, this certainly sounds very, very interesting. It needs to be looked at in greater detail." He asked permission if we could conduct a clinical trial under controlled conditions, and they said, "Yes, you can, providing it is supervised and managed by an established scientific institution." And I thought, great, this is wonderful. This is back in 2002, 2003, around about that time. I said, "This is wonderful, fantastic. But we're still looking for that scientific institution that's willing to take on the challenge. We haven't found it yet. They're still too scared to test it."
And was there any recidivism with any of the cases that you worked?
I can't answer that question because I had to come back to UK. And in fact, I was in the middle of my studies at the time, and I really couldn't follow it up. And this is, again, the reason why we need a scientific institution to look into this, because I'm just a one-man researcher. I'm teaching other people how to do it. I've got a caseload that I'm working with. I'm gathering research, and I'm showing how to integrate clinical practice with research and teaching. But I'm still only one man. This really takes a department in a scientific institution. What I'm really looking for is a psychiatric hospital or a clinic that has access to patients with common problems, like hearing voices, for example, where these methods can be tested under controlled conditions. I can't possibly do it alone.
All right, we'll take another quick time out, come back, and continue our discussion on the science of spirit possession with Dr. Terrence Palmer right here on The Conspiracy Show. Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. The Science of Spirit Possession with Dr. Terrence Palmer. He's standing by in England, and he'll join us for the full 2 hours. My technical producer is Owen Wolf. Live stream producer is Ryan White. However, no live stream this week. The live stream on YouTube returns next week. And the YouTube channel, of course, is Strange Planet. My guest, Dr. Palmer, insists that spirit possession, attachment, poltergeist activity, and the negative impact of obsession, infestation, and harassment on psychological health, together with the methods of dealing with it, are contemporary issues that demand serious scientific research and academic study. Dr. Palmer has a degree in psychology from Canterbury, Christ Church University, and a master's degree in the study of mysticism and religious experience from Kent University. He's been a hypnotherapist for 20 years and a spirit release practitioner for 12 years. His doctorate was awarded by the University of Wales at Bangor for his thesis on the scientific conceptual framework and research methods of 19th century researcher F.W.H. Myers. He is the first practitioner to be awarded a PhD on the topic of spirit release therapy in the United Kingdom. Terrence is a member of the Society for Psychical Research and the Scientific and Medical Network, and is a fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine. He's an active lecturer in encouraging UK institutions to take up the challenge to test the efficacy of spirit release therapy under controlled conditions. His book is The Science of Spirit Possession. Dr. Palmer, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Extremely well, Richard. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
My pleasure. I read with interest the title of your thesis, The Science of Spirit Possession, and I'm trying to imagine how that went when it came time to defend your thesis. How did that go? For example, because it's such a provocative title, did your professors at the time say, you know, Terrence, are you sure you really want to try and tackle this?
Well, I must confess that traversing the obstacles of academia was not easy. In fact, my thesis was entitled A Revised Epistemology of the, I'm trying to remember what it was. It's a very, very difficult academic title, but it's all to do with epistemology, a revised epistemology of the scientific framework of Frederick Myers, who was a 19th century researcher into life after death. The title, The Science of Spirit Possession, was given to the thesis when it was published.
Ah, okay. But then defending it. I mean, I'm just trying to understand how, you know, in academia, this whole subject matter is sort of perceived. And I mean, was there a great deal of pushback during your defense of the thesis?
No, there was a great deal of pushback during the researching and the writing of it. But my supervisor, an extraordinary young woman, academic, a Jungian psychologist, was very, very helpful. And she would say to me, listen, Terry, she'd say, you've got to learn how to deliver what the academic world wants to hear. So you have to couch your thesis in the language that's familiar to them, and you must keep your own ideas to yourself.
I mean, I might be reaching here, but my, at least my perception is, when I think of the academic world, certainly today, is that it is made up largely of, I mean, outside of, you know, theological courses, programs, it would be made up largely of materialists.
Yes. Now, I did my research for my doctorate at the University of Wales in Bangor, North Wales, in the department, in the School of Theology and Religious Studies. So my academic peers were scholars of theology. The psychology of religion, in other words, they were interested in what people believed about religion. And they weren't, I stand to be corrected on this, but this is the view that, that I came away with, that my peers in the department were, they certainly didn't believe in a spirit world. They didn't believe in God or devils or demons or anything like that. But they viewed the subject as a subject of a social and anthropological interest.
Right, right. Now, when I think of Great Britain, I think of, you know, such a rich history and tradition in the spiritualist movement and so forth. And I'm wondering, because, you know, you've also worked in the United States, how do you compare Great Britain's view of this subject matter, spirit possession, spirit attachment, a spirit oppression, with North America?
That's a very difficult question to answer. By and large, both countries are very, very skeptical in the mainstream. In the work that I do, in working with people who are possessed with spirits and helping to remove them, the view of the work that I do in both the USA and the United Kingdom from the mainstream is that the subject is supernatural nonsense and has no scientific validity. People who are hearing voices or diagnosed with mental illness are treated with drugs and put into hospital if they're psychotic. And the possibility that the voices they hear are real, coming from an external source, is not considered. And that applies to both countries, to the United States and to the UK. So there's not a great deal of difference there. But when it comes to the people themselves, ordinary people who are suffering from these afflictions, then there's a growing demand, a growing recognition from people that psychiatry does not have all the answers.
You mentioned Frederick Myers, and in your thesis, obviously, you celebrate his work.
Yes.
Sir Isaac Newton, you know, wrote, "If I have seen further, it is because I've stood on the shoulders of giants."
Yes.
So I guess Frederick Myers was sort of that person to you. Tell our listeners about Frederick Myers, his work, and why it's so important.
Well, I discovered the work of Frederick Myers when I was studying for my master's degree in the study of mysticism. I needed to understand mystic experience, and I discovered the work of Frederick Myers whilst I was studying for that. And when it came time to find a way through the academic quagmire to do my my doctorate, my supervisor suggested Frederick Myers, because I was already familiar with his work. Now, he was one of a number of scholars who contributed to the formation of the Society for Psychical Research in London in 1882. He was a Cambridge scholar, and he and his colleagues who formed the society were interested in investigating the scientific validity of what the spiritualists were doing. Spiritualists in the spiritualist churches, and it was very, very fashionable in the United States and in Victorian England, where people became very, very interested in communicating with the dead. And there was a lot of activity in the theatre. People were presenting stage productions and presenting seances, and it became very, very popular across a wide section of society. And Frederick Myers and his colleagues questioned the validity of this scientifically. They wanted to know if it had scientific validity and if it could be supported by scientific investigation. And that was why the society was set up in 1882. Now, Frederick Myers had a particular interest also in the survival of the of consciousness after physical death. So he spent 20 years investigating, looking at the evidence to support that hypothesis. And for him and for his colleagues and many people at that time, that hypothesis was firmly supported. And his book was published in 1903, and it's entitled The Survival of the Personality Following Bodily Death. And it provides a very, very good scientific foundation to support that hypothesis. Now, what interests me particularly is that in the modern world, his work is largely unknown and ignored by people who do know of it.
Hmm. And talk to me about his one of his principal research tools, or his principal research tool was something called magnetism. What is that all about?
For magnetism, we go back to Franz Mesmer. You've heard of mesmerism.
Yes.
The German, he was a scientist, and he challenged Father Johann Gassner, who was the proclaimed most powerful exorcist in all of Christendom in Europe in the 18th century. And Mesmer came along, challenged him, said, "I can do that using a scientific method." And his method he called animal magnetism. And it's this connection, this invisible connection between all living things in the universe and in between people in particular. And he demonstrated this. This later evolved, was replaced in 1845 by the term hypnosis, because there was a similarity between the outcomes of the two methods. Mesmerism was this transfer of magnetic power between people, and hypnosis was seen to be the power of suggestion by speaking the suggestion to a person. So there's a difference in the technique, but the outcome is very, very similar. So Frederick Myers was interested in what was this connection between the magnetizer and the magnetized, or the therapist and the patient. And he went to great lengths to explore its nature.
And Myers' conclusion was that he firmly believed in the reality of spirit oppression or possession, correct?
Yes, he did. But what I'd like to do is to reinforce the proposition. And you just used the word belief. And Frederick Myers himself would argue about this use of the word belief. And in fact, I'm going to refer to my own book now.
No, you're right. I use that as kind of a shorthand. I mean, he had little time for theology and metaphysics, but which is kind of so, centered around belief. But
so now for the benefit of your listeners,
yes.
I'm going to read a quotation from Frederick Myers. And this is on the opening page of my book. He says, "My discussion, I may say at once, will avoid metaphysics as carefully as it will avoid theology. For somewhat similar reasons, I do not desire to introduce the philosophical opinions which have been held by various thinkers in the past, nor myself to speculate on matters lying beyond the possible field of objective proof." That's a quotation from Myers himself. So what he's saying, really, is that it doesn't matter what you believe or what you think or what your opinion is, and I'm not going to debate any of that. I want to look for the proof to see what is, not what we think is.
Right. So he, yeah, so let me rephrase that. We'll take belief out. He came to the conclusion that yeah. in the reality, that spirit possession was a reality.
Yes, and he didn't set out to investigate that. He set out to investigate the scientific evidence to support the hypothesis that the spirit or consciousness leaves the body and survives the death of the body. And in so doing that, he discovered another very, very interesting concept that was being researched by psychiatrists and medicine at the same time, and that is this business of multiple personality, where a person's personality switches from one to another. So psychiatry was investigating multiple personality, which is now called dissociative identity disorder.
Yes.
And what Myers concluded was that the spirit of a person can be replaced by the spirit of another person. So it's very, very difficult to tell the difference between someone who has a multiple personality or an alternate personality and someone who's possessed.
Now, when he's looking for proof, you see, this is fascinating to me because we're talking about, in essence, an unseen world. We're talking about, discarnate entities. How does one go about gathering physical evidence for a non-physical phenomenon?
Well, that's very tricky. What science is perpetually trying to do is to provide physical evidence for the non-physical. Extremely difficult. We can only observe the outcome. For example, you can't see microwaves, but you can measure their effect. You can't see radio waves, but you can listen to the effect. There are many, many things in the universe that we can't see at all. In fact, our range of ability to observe is extremely limited, but we have instruments that can measure the effects, and the same applies to spirits.
Now, you were talking about your discovery of Frederick Myers' work, and you were working in the late 90s as a hypnotherapist.
Yes.
And you came across a number of these cases that just absolutely confounded you. And in fact, you describe them as being emotionally traumatic.
Yes.
Talk to me about some of those cases, if you could, that you first encountered, and they just could not be explained away using, I guess, more traditional psychological methods.
Yes. I'll give you a good example. A woman came to me. In fact, she was referred to me. I worked with a doctor. A general practitioner, and my consulting room was right next door to his, and he would refer patients to me to see if hypnosis would help them. And I also had my own patients that would come to see me. And this was one of my own patients, and this was a woman who had been suffering from depression for 16 years, and her husband was being driven to his wit's end, to the extent that he couldn't live with her any longer. She was driving him crazy. So he brought her to see me, and I attempted to investigate the cause of her depression. And the methods that I used were very, very simple. But what it required was for the person to go into an altered state of consciousness, to tap into their inner self, their inner emotions, and reveal what the cause of the problem was. I couldn't get this woman to do that at all. I was running out of ideas of how I could reach within. And then I just had an inspired thought. She had told me that 16 years earlier, she had given birth to a dead child. She'd had a stillbirth, okay? And this created the depression, and she's not been able to escape it for the past 16 years, which, you know, is really a long time to hold on to grief, irrespective of the circumstances. And this intrigued me, so I said to her, grasping at straws, I said, I asked a question that has an obvious answer, really. I said, how did you feel at the time of the stillbirth? And it was then her reaction that really surprised me. One moment she was a very, very grief-stricken woman, crying and very, very vulnerable. And next minute she sat bolt upright, and her eyes glazed over. They weren't focused, and she said in a very, very cold voice, it was his fault.
Oh, my.
And I said, whose fault was that? And she said, the doctor, of course, he should have known. So imagine I'm sitting there looking at a woman who's sat bolt upright with a stony face, cold. And so I said, should have known what? And she said, I had pleurisy, and he should have known that. He should have known that and saved my baby, but he didn't. So I wished the same thing on him. And she said, but then he couldn't have a stillborn child, could he? So he should have lost an arm or a leg or something like that.
Mm.
And I sat in stunned silence listening to this and just did not know how to deal with it. So I had to go away. This is just one example of several of a similar nature, cold and threatening in an emotional way. So I had to go away and research and read up on these things. And the first book that struck a chord with me was written by a Swiss psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Hans Nageli Osgood. And I picked up this book, and straight away I had a rejection against even looking inside it, because I thought, this is just not going to give me the answers I'm looking for.
Dr. Palmer, I'm going to jump in here, and we will take a quick time out. We'll come back, and we'll pick up on this point. And you are listening to The Conspiracy Show. We're talking about the science of spirit possession with Dr. Terrence Palmer. Back with more of our conversation right after this.
Keeping a watchful eye on the new world order. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. We are here with Dr. Terrence Palmer discussing the science of spirit possession. And you had a series of difficult cases as a hypnotherapist where you kind of hit this wall. You went away and you consulted this book.
Hans Nageli Osgood.
Nageli Osgood. Yeah. And the moment you cracked it open, you just kind of felt like, well, this isn't going to get me anywhere. Just explain a little bit further what you meant by that.
Well, the question I was asking, it was this business about cursing someone, wishing them ill will, and then something dreadful happens. Apparently, the wife of this doctor had a stillborn.
Yes.
So that raised serious questions. How is this possible? Does a curse actually work? If a curse works, how is it carried from A to B? How does it find its target? These were the questions that were running around in my mind. So I was investigating witchcraft, demonology, spirit possession, and so on. And I came across this book by Hans Nagliols called, it was called Possession and Exorcism. And I thought, what is a psychiatrist doing writing a book like this? But this book fell into my possession. And this is one of the interesting things about this kind of work. What I've discovered is that if I have a serious question to ask, I always get the answer. The answer is given to me one way or another. And I've learned to respect that. It's almost as if the universe is answering my question directly.
Right.
You can call it God if you like. You can call it synchronicity, but it works. So I got this book and I've looked inside it and I'm thinking, no, this can't be true. This can't be real. This can't be applied. But in this book, this psychiatrist gives a solution to the problem. And it's he addresses the problem by assuming the possibility that this person may have a spirit within them. And he doesn't know whether it's the spirit of a dead person, an earthbound spirit, or a demon or an angel or whatever it is. He can't see it. He can't hear it. He can't negotiate with it. So he wrote a prayer that addresses all these scenarios. And he first of all reads the Lord's Prayer from Christian religion. And then he says to the possessing spirit, if you're human, you're dead. If you're not human, then you have to go. And there's a detailed prescription of how to deal with this. And I had no alternative to turn to, so I thought, well, let's give it a try. You know, let's see what happens. So I contacted the husband of this woman, and I said, when you bring her to the next consultation, can you come into the consulting room with her? Because I'd like you to be there and witness what I say to her. So he said, okay, fine. And we sat down, and I read from Lee Osgood's book, I read the Lord's Prayer, and I looked across at him and he looked at me as if, you know, what are you doing? And the woman started to writhe in her chair and get very, very uncomfortable. And then I carried on with the prescription from the book. And after a few moments, the dust settled, so to speak, and the woman went into a very, very emotional, traumatic experience, floods of tears and verging on the violent. And then she got very, very peaceful, went into a sort of half sleep-like state and was very calm. And her husband and I looked at each other and raised their shoulders and, you know, with this quizzical look as if to say, well, what the hell happened there?
Mm.
But so it solved the problem. So that gave me my first insight into the possibility that this is real. At this point, I had to start thinking back through my own experiences, back to my childhood, back to my younger days as a soldier and my early career and so on. And then I began to realize that I had encountered experiences before that were dismissed out of hand, quite simply because of the education that we have. I'm talking about myself, I'm talking about friends, colleagues, family. We are educated in the modern scientific world to reject these ideas from a very, very early age. So by the time we reach adulthood, we have a clear mind, so to speak, that is not infected with ideas of spirits or angels or gods or anything else. So I had to think back, and then I began to realize that there were incidences where I'd been tapped on the shoulder, to use a metaphor, about these things. And I realized that I had been ignoring these things all my life, and they had validity. I was then very, very interested in discovering two things. I needed to find a way to treat the people that were coming to me for help, and I needed to find scientific validity for it. And I did.
But is it fair to sort of describe that moment when you decided, okay, let's try this? I mean, there's a saying in or an expression in sports. I don't know if you have it in England. It's called the Hail Mary pass, where it's kind of an American football. The quarterback will throw this very long pass as the clock is winding down. He doesn't really expect anyone to catch it, but it's like, at this point, what do I have to lose? Was this kind of a Hail Mary pass?
The way you describe it, I suppose it could apply, really. But no, not really. It was a long process of investigation and discovery. I followed three avenues to try to find an answer to this question. I followed my scientific training in psychology, using scientific method to understand what was happening, and I discovered nothing in psychology, not mainstream psychology at all. And I could see that mainstream psychology and psychiatry were going off completely in the materialistic direction, that everything that you experience is according to the brain. And I investigated that, and I found that that is not true at all. And the other avenue I explored was to go and visit spiritualist churches and see how they did things, how they communicated with the spirit world. So I went back to the ideas and the research and the methods that Friedrich Myers used over 100 years ago and started putting them into practice. And lo and behold, they worked.
And this woman, the case of this woman who had suffered from debilitating depression for 16 years after a stillborn birth. The depression was completely gone after that?
It cured her completely. And in fact, a few days, about 2 weeks after that, I just happened to be walking along the street one day and I bumped into her in the street. And she invited me to her home and made me a cup of tea and said, thank you very much. My life has changed. Emotions are energetic. They have an energetic frequency. We live in a material world that's solid. It's actually condensed energy that operates at a very, very low frequency. And as you move up from the physical into the emotional and the mental and the spiritual, the vibrations change. It's like changing the frequency on a radio or television set, and you can access different channels. Now, extreme emotional distress emits a powerful frequency charge. And now this is where you need to use a little bit of imagination, but I've gathered scientific evidence to support this hypothesis that I'm going to present to you, okay? As we go about our business as human beings, we are emitting an energetic charge. We have varying degree of frequency. Some people have a low frequency. They go through life morose, depressed, angry, And that attracts a certain type of person. All alcoholics attract each other. People who are drug takers attract each other. People who love to sing and dance attract each other. It's the business of like attracts like. Mm-hmm. It's what we call sympathetic resonance, okay? So when a person has an extremely powerful negative energetic discharge of emotion, it attracts the energetic resonance of beings that use that discharge for their own sustenance. It's like a food to them. It's like plugging into an energy source. These life forms, often intelligent, complex, they exist in other dimensions that are in parallel to ours on a daily basis, and I mean daily, every single day. I'm working with people who suffer from these problems. And what we do, now I'm the scientist and I don't see or hear spirit, but I work with people who do, people who are mediumistic. and I will connect with spirit beings that you might call guides or light workers or beings of light. They're from other dimensions. You can call them angels if you like, but they do exist. They have intelligence. In fact, they have super intelligence. And we work with these beings and we ask them to scan the frequencies and find out what's there interfering with the person and ask them to have the infection removed. And that's precisely how it works.
We'll take another quick time out, come back and continue to delve into the science of spirit possession right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay with us.
The truth is not out there. It's right here. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
And we are back with Dr. Palmer, the science of spirit possession. You talked about synchronicity a little earlier. And there's a, I mean, I love serendipity and synchronicities, but here's a wonderful example. While you're sort of on this journey of discovery, you're in a bookstore. And you're you're approached by, I guess she's a sales associate, and she's asking for help. Tell me about that story. What happens?
Okay, she told me that she was experiencing unexplained anger. She'd be out with her friends socializing, and then suddenly she had this irresistible feeling that she wanted to kill everybody, and it was really worrying her a lot. So she invited me to investigate for her. So I went to her home, and to cut a long story short, as they say, one minute I'm sat there with a peaceful, intelligent, educated woman, and the next minute I'm being stared at, glowered at, by a very, very angry person who wants to kill me. Took me completely by surprise. I did not know how to deal with this at all. So it just reinforced the message I was getting that I need to learn how to deal with this. And that was when I decided to go away to find someone who understood these things, who could teach me. And I went to see a psychiatrist in London who'd been to the United States to be trained by William Baldwin. But he wasn't in a position to be able to teach me, so he referred me to a married couple who had also been to the United States, and they'd been trained by a psychiatrist called Irene Hickman, and they taught what they called the Hickman Method. So I went along to their training, and the way it worked was that we were invited. There were about six or seven of us on this training course. It lasted 5 days. And each of us was invited to write down the name of a person that we thought could possibly be helped by the method that was being taught. So I wrote down the name of the woman in the bookshop. And the idea was that you pulled a name out of the hat, and that was the case that you were working on. And it just so happened the name I pulled out of the hat was the same name as the woman in the bookshop. So I was given the opportunity to investigate using this method, this woman's unexplained anger. And what I found myself being at one. It's the only way I can describe it. I became the possessing spirit of that woman. And I became the earthbound spirit of a North American Indian whose tribe had been decimated during the North American Indian Wars of the 19th century. And he was still seeking retribution and revenge for the genocide of his tribe. And I must confess, I didn't know that such rage could exist in the breast of a man. And I experienced it firsthand. It was traumatic. It was profound. But the experience for me was to be taken, to be guided to the light where all spirits go when they leave, where all spirits are supposed to go when they leave the body. Now, you can reconcile this with religious teaching or not, but this is a reality that I've discovered. When the body dies, the conscious mind, the spirit, leaves the body and it needs to return home to the light. If it doesn't go to the light, it remains earthbound and it lives a life of pain and suffering until it finds a release. And that was my training.
And we're talking, this method, we're talking about spirit release therapy.
Yes.
We're coming up on a break in just about a minute and a half here, but let's start talking about spirit release therapy, what that involves in a little more detail, and then we'll pick it up on the other side, so to speak, no pun intended. Spirit release therapy, how does it work? What are the protocols, if you will?
Okay. Let me make the distinction between two types here. Spirit release therapy is where the practitioner is a therapist working face to face, one to one with the patient, as I was working with the woman who was depressed, that I was being a therapist, okay? But remote spirit release, which was the method that was taught to me when I released the American medicine chief to the light, that's done remotely, where the subject is in another place. It could be many miles away. So there's a distinct difference. One is remote and one is face-to-face.
Okay. Why don't we leave it there? We'll take a time out, come back, and we'll continue to delve into spirit release therapy. And then I want to, in the next hour, talk about a string of fascinating cases that you worked utilizing SRT, we'll call it for shorthand. Back with more of my conversation with Dr. Terrence Palmer, right here on The Conspiracy Show.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.